This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Probably one of the main reasons why the national park got finally approved is that the Goldman Prize shamed the Iraqi government into acting.
Last week, we spoke with Azam Alwash, who earned a 2013 Goldman Prize for restoring a vast marshland in Iraq that had been drained and depleted under Saddam Hussein. This week on Sea Change Radio, we continue our discussion with Alwash, who has a refreshingly optimistic view of Iraq's long-term prospects. He shares his hopes about cooperation with neighbors like Turkey, personal opinions about the war, unconventional ideas about what to do with some of the country's minefields, and talks about the road he took to move his organization Nature Iraq from a small grassroots campaign to a triumphant and internationally acclaimed movement. Now, in the earlier part of our discussion, Azam, you had mentioned that birds have no passports. What does the refilling of the marshes in Iraq mean for the entire region, in your opinion, beyond its borders?
When you look at the marshes, Alex, the marshes are essentially, in engineering terms, a flood basin. It's a flood retention basin. You see, the Tigris and Euphrates originate in the mountains of Kurdistan, a fictitious nation that is shared currently by Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. In it live the people, Kurds, are known as Kurds. But regardless of that, since nature knows no boundaries, the mountains of Kurdistan are actually the source of the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates. Fully 60% of the water of the Tigris and Euphrates comes to southern Iraq in the snow melt in the spring. 100 billion cubic meters of water comes down the Tigris and Euphrates. About 60 billion of it, 60, 70 billion of it, comes in the spring. All this water wants to get to the Gulf, but the flow capacity of Shatt al-Arab is limited. So what happens? There's flooding in southern Iraq. And the flooding, as it happens, was the reason why agriculture lasted in southern Iraq for 7,000 years without the need for fertilizer. Why? Because the water comes laden with silt and clay from the mountains of Kurdistan. And it washes away the brackish water, the salt that accumulates from evaporation from the year before. And it deposits a new layer of silt and clay on the grasslands, on the farmlands surrounding these marshes of southern Iraq. And it is, in fact, the engine of biodiversity. It is the beat of the symphony of biodiversity in southern Iraq. The flood comes in the spring just as the reeds are coming out of winter hibernation, just as the birds are migrating, just as the fish is spawning, and it's not haphazard. This is the fabric of biodiversity. Everything evolves around this pulse that comes in every summer. And so if I want the marshes restored, I mean, people ask me, are the marshes restored? I say the marshes are reflooded. They're not restored. We will never return the marshes to the way they were because of dams upstream. And this is the irony of our age at this point. You know, we're all looking at reducing CO2. We're all looking at alternative energy. And we're building hydroelectric dams. Well, hydroelectric dams, theoretically, are a very good idea because they produce electricity without burning fossil fuel. But what is not seen as the result of these huge dams is the fact that they change the biodiversity downstream. Point to the Colorado River to your viewers, to your listeners. The Colorado River is similar to the Tigris and Euphrates. We have the Hoover Dam, we have Lake Powell, we have Lake Mead, and we have all sorts of lakes that are generating electricity and providing Southern California and Southern Southwest, the Southwest of the United States, with water. Well, guess what? That is having a negative effect on the Gulf of Mexico. Right? Because the Gulf of Mexico is not getting the water that it used to get. So the quality of the water in the Gulf of Mexico is deteriorating as a result of the dams. Now, we have to balance. We have to see which one works. I mean, you know, everybody wants water in Southern California. Nobody wants to leave Southern. Anyway, the parallels are really immense. I mean, Mexico has won a couple of lawsuits against the United States. But I say to Iraqis, you know, and Iraqis are looking at me for help on how to deal with Turkey and the dams that are being built in Turkey. Because in fact, the hydro, as I told you, the hydro pulse, the flooding pulse is over because of dams being built upstream. And I can't fault Turkey for doing this. Turkey wants electricity. Turkey wants to improve the standard of living of the Turks. Iraqis are saying, well, you know, international law is with us. And they're right. Iraqis do have clay tablets from 7,000 years ago saying that they were the first developers of the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates, and therefore they should not be deprived of water. But you and I know that international law is only applied on the weak. It is not applied on the strong. And Turkey in this instance is a NATO member. Iraq is a country being, you know, had 30 years of war. It has sectarian violence now. They can't. It's futile to talk about international rights. So I keep on now talking to my Iraqi friends. I tell them that if we continue along the path that we're continuing, we will first lose agriculture in Iraq due to salinization and desertification. And more importantly, you're not going to solve the problem. 6 years from now, you're still going to be talking about international law, sort of like the Palestinian-Israeli issue. You know, you need to change the dialogue, guys. You need to change the dialogue from the political question of whose water this is to how can we benefit together. And there are solutions. One of them, let's buy electricity from Turkey. Instead of buying water from Turkey, let's buy electricity from Turkey. You'll solve the electrical problem in Iraq. Turkey will have an income. More importantly, Turkey will not lose that electricity to transport it from the southeast Turkey to Istanbul. They'll have 10% more, 10-15% more electricity to sell. So they'll make money, and we will get electricity, but more importantly, we'll get water as a byproduct.
Without having to invest that kind of infrastructure that Turkey's already.
Exactly. Invested. I mean, the solution is in the free market. The solution is in changing the discussion from the political. So how can we make a deal? And so that's my next challenge.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Azam Alwash of Nature Iraq. Azam, what's your long-term view? Say 30 years, what's your long-term view of the region as a whole?
My view of the Middle East in 30 years is that we're going to use these challenges, issues of water, issues of disputed territory, as a way to jumpstart, to move into the future where we can cooperate and work together by converting the problem between Iraq and Turkey from whose water this is to how we can make an economic relationship. I believe that the economic relationships are going to pretty soon wipe the borders. And I see a Middle East in 20, 30 years, call it the Green Crescent, an area that has no borders, a regional cooperation area that includes Turkey and maybe hopefully even Israel and Iran, where actually we don't have borders, but we have cooperation to work together, to live together, and to compete with the European bloc, with the Asian bloc, because in fact, if we stay fragmented, there's no way out. There's no way out. The only way out of this is for us to start working together and use our complementary talents. Iraq has a lot of oil. Iraq has a lot of soil and a lot of farmlands. If we work with Turkey, we can bring in the water. We can have agriculture both in Turkey and in Iraq. We can help Turkey with oil resources. The cooperation methods are there. It's available. And for those skeptics, I say, yeah, well, Europe, 17 years after World War II, created the common market. What? Why did they do that? Did the French started loving the British, or the British fall in love with the Germans all of a sudden, or was it their economic situation that dictated the creation of the common market. I say pretty soon in the Middle East, we're going to face the same realities. We're going to have to come up to the plate, and with all the young people growing up in the region, there must be a way out. And the only way out is actually the free market and democracy. Now, we're seeing some of that happening very slowly. Yeah, two steps forward, one step back, two step forward, one step back. But you know what? It's in the general right direction. I know people listen to news about the Middle East and they kind of say, blow their heads, oh, another suicide bombing, another place of violence, extremism, and all of that. But I have faith in the future.
One of the elements that I think makes your optimistic vision more realistic is also all the work that's being done to try to get us off of fossil fuels and minimizing the role of oil, coupled with the militarization of that region, kind of led us to a place where nature and the environment has been de-emphasized. But you think that's going to be resurgent?
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, when oil loses its value, it ceases to become a strategic asset that the world would be competing for or for influence in. 20 years from now, the oil in Iraq is probably going to stay underground because there's no market for it. And then what? And then what are you going to do? And how are you going to feed your people? Really, we have to start looking over the horizon. Oil and fossil fuel are the energy of the past. Energy of the future is sunlight. Sun is shining, the weather is sweet. Make you want to move your dancing feet to the rescue. Here I am. Want you to know you're where I stand.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Iraqi environmentalist Azam Alwash. Can we take a step back real quick?
Sure.
Can you talk about the soapbox that you had to stand on to get heard? What megaphone did you use when you returned back to Iraq in 2003 to 2007 during this period to try to build a coalition of people, yeah, building up the voice of Nature Iraq?
At the beginning of this interview, I told you about my father, the irrigation engineer. Mr. Jawad Alwash, apparently unbeknownst to me, I mean, he's my father. I love him. But unbeknownst to me, he apparently was one of the most revered engineers in the Ministry of Water Resources. And so when I went back and I started working with the Ministry of Water Resources, first of all, and well, I started working actually in Nasriya, which is the hometown that I grew up in. And my God, my father's name opened so many doors. Azam, you're the son of Abu Azam? Yeah, I am. How is he? Well, you know, 2005, he passed away in 2007. He's well, he's old and all of that. So please pass my regards to him. Anyway, that opens up, you know, in Iraq, the personal touch is very, very, very important. And the family name is very, very important. And the fact that my dad had a very good reputation actually helped me tremendously in establishing connections with the locals at first, the stakeholders, but more importantly, with the Ministry of Water Resources. A lot of the engineers that are running the ministry today were actually trainees of his. And fortunately, apparently, he was a very good boss because everybody loves him. You know, it's like, Azam's like, oh, how's your father?
He did not emigrate to the U.S.
No, he was in Washington, D.C., actually. He immigrated to the U.S. in 1990. So.
But he had made his mark already, it sounded like.
Indeed. And then his name opened so many doors for me. It created the goodwill that is needed. I didn't need to prove my credentials. I used my father's name to establish my credentials. So I owe him that. And, you know, the circle of life, as it were.
Did you use the media effectively? How did that?
There was no media to talk of. I mean, this is just grassroots, pure activism, grassroots, trying to help. And you know, when things got tough, when trying to get the dispute between the ministries get resolved, I started helping the locals, or teaching the locals, or guiding, coaching the locals on how to use their newly found democratic voice. And I'll tell you, and I'll go on the record, that I rented buses and I took locals to Baghdad to go visit the Kadhim, you know, to go to the religious duties, and arranged for meetings with the ministry or the prime minister's office or whomever, while we're trying to make the case, look, we are the locals, we support this national park idea. And soon enough, they started actually doing this by themselves. This is an area. I mean, we didn't have democracy from 1958 till 2003. The order of the day was the president orders and everybody executes. They are not used to local organization moving up and having their voice be heard. That's not how it worked. And so that was one of the ways of establishing credentials, of establishing trust. And then I started using local media. By 2005, 2008, Al-Hurra and international media becomes very, very important. I will go on the record and say also that probably one of the main reasons why the national park got finally approved is that the Goldman Prize shamed the Iraqi government into acting. When the prize was given to me for grassroots activism, for trying to create the national park, it made a huge splash in Iraq. Huge splash. Here is an Iraqi who won an international award, who met Obama. And I used that opportunity actually to press in the local press, saying, look, we've been talking about this national park for now 5 years. You know, it's time to act it. And I actually was invited to the prime minister's office finally to make the case. And I made the case, and within 2 weeks, it moved to the agenda. Now, it took a couple of meetings because the agenda is always full of security issues, and usually the national park is down at the bottom of the agenda. But we finally made it 3 weeks ago.
What does it mean for the people who used to live there, the establishment of a national park?
It's now got the stamp of approval from the prime minister's office. It now can be budgeted. Now we have to go. And when I go back to Iraq in 5 days, we will begin the earnest process of trying to work with the Ministry of Environment on how to create the management plan, create the budget for it, train the guides, train the people, and come up with the details of the projects on how we're going to develop this national park into an ecotourist destination. And my plans are actually to focus on the oil workers in southern Iraq, who are only 20, 25 minutes away from these marshes. We have 20,000 foreigners who have not seen this treasure, who don't even know that it exists. And if we can come and have them visit 100 people at a time, I can envision buses going back and forth, you know, give them 3 days tours to enjoy the area. Anyway, the untold truth is that there's too many people that have come back. There's so many fishermen fishing using electrocution now instead of the traditional methods, that they're overstressing the environment. They're not giving Mother Nature enough time to heal.
If by the establishment of this region of becoming a national park, will this kind of practice be prohibited?
I can sit and say, look, fishing is not good. But in the end of the day, if my child is hungry, I'll do whatever I need to do to feed my child. And so the idea here of the creation of the national park is eventually going to create alternative sources of income for people so that they will understand that, in fact, the protection of nature will bring them more income. But it's a slow process. It's not going to happen in 2 years. It's going to happen in 10 years, I hope, maybe 20 years. This is a multi-decadal project. This is a multi-generation project. It's going to take a long time. And if I have, my American side is impatient. I want it done today. I want it done now. But the last 10 years of going back to Iraq has retaught me the value of patience, that you cannot hurry things. Time has no value almost in the Middle East, by the way. I forgot that. I forgot my growing up. It's we have to do things the good old slow way.
How do politics, environmentalism, and intimidation intersect in Iraq?
Between 2004 and 2006, whenever we had an expedition in southern Iraq, we had guards, and sometimes more guards than scientists. And that's because the law was not existent. Kidnapping for ransom was the norm. In fact, we had 5 of our people got kidnapped. And that's the problem. If you get kidnapped, then you have to, you know, as management, I have to face, all right, if I pay ransom, I've just basically opened a Pandora's box. Basically, every time people see my kids out in the field collecting data, oh, there's ransom. I can take this guy and make $500 a day. So I decided not to pay ransom. But that's endangering the hostages that they took. So what I did was basically negotiate with the parents. I told them, I'm not going to pay ransom for these reasons. They went ahead and negotiated with the kidnappers, and ransom was paid. And I made sure that the families was compensated in a roundabout way within 6 months for not having a loss. But at least now everybody understands that if you kidnap people from Nature Iraq, you're not going to make money.
There must be something in the way I feel that she don't want me to feel. Starship bears a cut me. I don't care. You see, so what if I bleed? Like I never change is what I feel. My face will never show what is not real.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Iraqi environmentalist and 2013 Goldman Prize winner, Azam Awash. Azam, as somebody who left Iraq when Saddam was coming to power and returned after he was removed, I'm sure that your view of the American invasion of Iraq must be different than many Americans. But from an environmental perspective, can you talk about your feelings when you first started seeing bombs being dropped on CNN in Iraq to today? How do you feel about the military intervention by the U.S. there from an environmental perspective?
I'll tell you my view as an American, my view as an American of Iraqi heritage, but also my view as somebody who loves nature, my view as somebody who have become enshrined, have become saturated with feelings for democracy. And I will be lying if I told you I was sad at the war. That would be an untruth. War in general, of course, is not accepted, and it's not a good way to solve problems, but as somebody who has lived in Iraq, who understands Iraq, I knew that Saddam was never going to be removed peacefully or through an internal reform. And so the war was almost inevitable. I just hoped that it would be done quickly with as little damage or as little killing as possible. It's not that the war with Iraq has begun the killing spree. It was, in fact, the end of the killing spree that Saddam started back in 1968 when Ba'ath took over. I mean, the mass graves are still being discovered right now in southern Iraq. 2 million people died in the war, well, died or got injured in the Iraq-Iran war. Today, we're still dealing with the legacy of 25 million mines on the borders between Iraq and Iran. I will also say that the restoration of the marshes could not have been possible with Saddam in place. So it's a dilemma. I'm a liberal. I'm a tree hugger. but I'm also a supporter of the war. It's a strange place to be. And so I used to be black and white in the old days. I no longer am. I'm different shades of gray. Here is an instance where war has resulted in the largest environmental restoration. Here is a war that resulted in the creation of a national park in the middle of a wetland, in the middle of a desert. Here is a war that has resulted in the stopping of state terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism. Yes, there is sectarian killing, but that is not because of Iraq. That's because of regional politics. For the Americans who kind of worry about the moral implication of the invasion of Iraq and the removal of Saddam Hussein, I tell them Iraqis are happy that Saddam was removed. Yeah, there is maybe 10, 15%, 20% of the population that lost privilege. But go to Kurdistan today. They would love you. They would kiss you. Go to southern Iraq. They would love you. They would kiss you. And so, by and large, the removal of Saddam Hussein will be viewed in the long term as a good moral. Who would argue with the removal of Hitler in 1938? Had the world had the balls, the guts to remove Hitler in 1938, would we have suffered the 20 million deaths of World War II, or no, 60 million? I don't even remember how many from history. But how can he justify war? I mean, it's conflict.
Well, from an environmental perspective, what we in the environmental journalistic world are exposed to mostly are stories about the American military's carbon footprint in the region, the massive amount of machinery and chemicals and weaponry that has gone into that region from the invasion, and also the explosion of lots of bombs and the use of quite a bit of fossil fuel to generate all this. But that's a pretty one-sided perspective that we're getting.
Yeah, and balance that with the largest restoration of wetlands.
And the removal of these mines. And
well, the removal of mines have not started yet, and I'm actually advocating for not removing them.
Oh, because it's so hard to do?
Well, not just that. Irony of ironies is that, in fact, the existence of the mines have prevented the hunters from going inside. So now we have an explosion of the number of leopards, Persian leopards, and goats, and wildlife is thriving in the mountains of Kurdistan because of the irony of the existence of the mines.
So the mines have scared away poachers.
Indeed. Hmm. Indeed. So why remove them? Why spend incredible amount of money on a removal process that is never 100% complete?
I guess especially in these wildlife areas, but in populated regions.
Of course,
obviously.
In populated areas, of course, in oil fields, you got to remove them. But in the wild areas, why bother? Why not create national parks? Hmm. In fact, I have a plan on the table to create a series of national parks on the mountains between Iraq and Iran, calling them peace parks. You know, we'll clear a path for tourists and tell them, do not leave these paths.
Or you will be blown up.
Quite literally, you'll be blown up.
Yeah, that's you're thinking about how to enforce these things right there.
Thinking outside the box. We'll create picnic areas, enjoy nature, but within limits. I'm seriously advocating for that. I mean, it's really, majority of these mines are plastic mines. You can't even detect them. And so why bother?
He's the 2013 Goldman Prize winner for helping to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq, Azam Awash. Azam, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by O'Donnell Levy, Bob Marley, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week
as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.